Merkel Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Marius, Tack Theratrix.
I am Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
Swangles in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the CS hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you're watching us on Iconic, Odyssey, Rockfin, Band.video, or we're listening wherever podcasts are served, thanks so much. We appreciate your support. If you want to follow us on Twitter, you can do so at Macroaggression. The website is theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. Big thank you to the sponsors that make this show happen. C60 Purple Power is fantastic. They've got a great website you can go check out. It's called shopc60.com. There's going to be a link in the show notes. You don't have to memorize it. There's not going to be a test. But this product is fantastic. The guys that invented it wound up winning the Nobel Prize. It's kind of a big deal. The spherical hollow soccer ball cage structure makes it a free radical sponge. Buckminster Fuller theorized about this carbon 60 atom for many, many years. It took a team of scientists to actually finally find it decades later, and they were rewarded with the Nobel Prize. So I think if it's good enough for them to win that prize, not that Nobel Prizes mean a whole lot these days, but if it was good enough for them back in the 80s to win it, hey, maybe take a look at it. It's a substance you probably have never heard of. It helps to optimize mitochondrial function. It promotes a balanced immune response. It assists with mild memory loss associated with aging. So provided that you can remember this ad and buy the product, then you're probably going to be good. You should be fine. It supports athletic performance and recovery. It boosts energy, mental clarity, and stamina. It's pretty cool. So go to shopc60.com. On your way out, use the promo code MACRO. Save yourself a couple of bucks. These statements and products have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, prevent, or mitigate any disease. ShopC60.com, promo code MACRO. Read up about it. See what you think. Also, big thanks. Good Lord. We all know we need to get prepared. I'm tired of it. I'm tired of having to say this, but I will continue to remind everybody to get prepared, because what I don't want to have happen is people not taking this seriously. We have supply chain issues. We have food processing facilities that are exploding when they're not getting hit by airplanes. We have trains filled with fertilizer derailing for some reason. We have Russia unable to export fertilizer. We have Ukraine having issues with wheat. We have Canada insisting that their farmers reduce their fertilizer use by 30%. China is not shipping anything from their ports in Hong Kong and Shenzhen, or they're at least backed up by months. And by the time it gets to the United States, it's sitting off the port of Long Beach for months there too. This is a huge problem. We see this everywhere. There's going to be major supply chain issues. You don't want to be the last person to figure this out. My Patriot Supply has been nice enough. They built us a landing page called preparewithmacroaggressions.com. That link will also be in the show notes. So you can click on that, get yourself sorted out for a 4-week supply of food, a 3-month supply of food. They have survival gear. They have survival coffee, whatever that is. I guess it lasts for 25 years. So that'll keep you going. Look, if you're set up, great. If there's a family member of yours that isn't set up, maybe isn't taking this seriously and you want to hook them up, you can always buy some, have it sent to them. Maybe you're interested in converting some of your soon to be worthless Federal Reserve notes into tangible assets like, oh, I don't know, food. Worse places to put your money than to buy storable food at this point in time, considering we're going to be going into a period of a lot of uncertainty. So look, if you don't get prepared through my sponsor, just get prepared however you can. Go to the grocery store, buy extra things, keep them stored away. Don't freak your family out. You don't need to make them insane, but just quietly accumulate as much as you can, because we know it's coming. We do have an advantage though, because we can see this on the horizon, because supply chain issues take months to actually hit you personally. We have a long timeline to take a look, but that timeline is getting shorter and shorter each day. You do not want to wait. You don't want to be fighting somebody for toilet paper. So get yourself ready. Prepare with macroaggressions.com. And you can save yourself some money on 4-week supplies and also 3-month supplies of food. Well, last time John Brisson was on, he talked about CNP, and everyone went, that was the most fascinating conversation I've ever heard about an organization that I didn't know existed. He's back to tell you about another organization that you may not know exists. And I promise you it's going to be just as fascinating, maybe a little bit darker, but we need to get through this. It's John Brisson, everybody. Hey, John, what's going on? Good to see you again.
You as well, Charlie. Glad to be back here on Macro Aggressions. And yeah, I mean, people should be preparing, not in fear.
Nope.
You know, but you should be preparing. I mean, you should have food on hand anyway, just in case there's some sort of natural disaster, or maybe man-made influence disaster. But I mean, you know, there have been times where I live in North Carolina, roads get shut off due to hurricanes. You know, mm-hmm. So I mean, you know, it's always important to have food on hand just in case.
Just in case. Nothing wrong with preparing. They would like you to be unprepared. They would like you to be at the mercy of the state. So I am in favor of doing whatever you can to make yourself a little bit more self-sufficient. I understand this is going to be a mess. We can't control all of this, but to the extent that it is in your control, say buying extra food, I feel like that should just be a no-brainer and everybody should take care of that. But like you said, coming from a place not of fear, but of preparedness. And that way you don't scare your family when you show up with 18 containers of food from Costco or from My Patriot Supply or someplace.
So, Charlie, have you heard about the Finders operation? Most people call it the Finders Cold or the Finders. Like, when did you initially hear about it? I'll talk about when I initially heard about it myself. But when did you, you know, I'm sure you've heard about it before. I'm sure, you know, you've came across it before. So when did you come across it? Do you remember?
I came across it about the same time I came across the Franklin scandal, because I would get them confused. I thought that there was, well, I'm not even fully sure. I thought they were connected. They might be. There might be some overlap, or it might, if it's a Venn diagram, there might be an intersecting component. But I always thought they were, initially, I thought they were part of the same thing. And it might have been because it was around the same time frame. Or at least to me, it seemed like it
was. It is around the same time. Fine, you're right.
So that, and I'll throw in, I'll group these all together. I'll also group the McMartin preschool in that. I remember that from living in Southern California, actually living in Manhattan Beach for 9 years, years later, like a full decade after that. But I remember going, McMartin preschool, that was all over our local news. So I've got these, you know, if it involves child abductions, like a coordinated child abductions, and it was happening in the 80s. I kind of put all those together.
Yeah, I mean, I learned about it from reading initially the Franklin scandal, which was Nick Bryant's book on the Franklin scandal. His first chapter is actually devoted to, you know, the Finders and coming across the customs document released by that they were Ramon J. Martinez's documents, but he's claimed that he never released them, that they just that they just were released, which I do believe Ramon on that. And I do respect Ramon heavily, and I'll talk about Ramon later.
And Nick Bryant was on here like 6 weeks ago.
And I respect Nick Bryant a lot. I really do, with his work with Franklin, his work with Epstein. He recently interviewed Alicia Owen again, who, you know, she was abused in the Franklin scandal and always stuck by her testimony and never wavered and actually suffered jail time because of that. And so, you know, and so that's when I came across it, which was many, many, many years ago. Mm-hmm. And then I was researching the CMP about 2017. And I don't know, I don't exactly remember how I was on. I remember I was sitting in the shed researching on my computer, but somehow I came across some information about the Finders of someone who I'm going to discuss later, who was around the Finders Nexus. And that would be Hunter Doherty Patch Adams, who the movie Patch Adams, which was played by Robin Williams, was loosely based on. And that he was a member of the Finders operation. And I don't remember anybody talking about that. So I just dived like head into it at that point. And that's when I noticed that, Derek Brose, you know, he was also researching the Finders operation too, as well. And then he released this excellent documentary, on the Finders, and he's interviewed Finders operation member, who was one of, Marion Petty's right-hand men, Tobe Terrell, twice. He's interviewed him twice. I'm always appreciative of Derek Brose's work, you know, on the Finders.
Was that Who Will Find operation. What the Finders Hid?
Who Will Find with the Finders Hide? That was the name of his documentary. Yeah. Yes. And so, you know, I contacted with Derek and we shared information. You know, and I just continued to research it after that, which Derek had some, but, you know, I was like, okay, well, I need to get down to the bottom of this. And so there are some misconceptions about the Finders, and I'll talk about what, and I've spent hundreds of hours researching at this point. And as investigative journalists, I actually contacted people and interviewed people, both off the record and on the record. And those off the record, I can't talk. But, you know, sometimes just people still gave me documents and they still gave me stuff that had never before seen. Like I have the complete investigated leads memo I have, which I've released. I have the complete Washington DC Finders chronology that's unredacted. I released that. You know, so I actually got documents that had disappeared or at one time were available but aren't available anymore. I mean, that's what investigative journalism is trying to track people down and interview them and get documents to prove, you know, whatever the truth is, not necessarily what you believe. Because there's, you know, we'll talk about how I initially believed, like most people, that the six Finders kids in the Tallahassee incident, that the Finders operation had kidnapped them. Well, that's not true. They were kids of the members of the Finders operation, and I'll discuss who their parents are within the operation, and it's provable. But where the Finders operation of itself, which is a highly compartmentalized operation, I have to say that, all right, so not everybody that was a member of the Finders, and people would come and go, okay, because it's usually how operations work. Did they know what, you know, I would say the only person who truly knew mostly everything that happened would be the leader, who was Marion Petty, and I'll discuss Marion Petty in a minute. And of course, you know, him working for the United States CIA, Israeli Mossad, you know, the military industrial complex, you know, the world elite, you know, they knew majority, you know, of what Marion Petty was doing and was probably, you know, telling him to do certain stuff. Or maybe they were just like, hey, you just go be a chaos agent. You just steer, you know, certain things like the human potential movement or the counterculture, you know, you just steer them in a direction of what you think that should be steered in. So it could just be that, you know, or collect all the information you can on all these people that are involved with these things, right? And then bring that information back to us. So there are certain, we don't know for sure because, you know, it's not like we have the actual operation documents 100%, you know, declassified right in front of me that I can give to y'all, you know, but there are things that we can logically come to conclusions on, and we can logically discuss through the information that we have of what happened. So the grand maximum, yes, the CIA, the Mossad, military industrial complex, non-government agencies use the Finders to steer and gain information on the counterculture movement, the human potential movement, you know, that's the Beat Generation, you know, that's for sure. Okay. Now, the degree of what they ordered it, did they say, Marion Petty, I need you to specifically talk to this person. I need you to do this. Or are they just like, hey, we give you carte blanche to do whatever you want. You know, if you step out of those boundaries, then we'll reprimand you. But, you know, pretty much, you know, give us information when we ask you, do this when we tell you to do it. But you can go sow chaos and do whatever you want, pretty much. Okay. So it could be that too. We really don't know, you know. So
when did it start? Let's just get back to the beginning. So it's been called cult-like. It's been called a communal lifestyle. It's been called a child trafficking organization. It's been called an intelligence honey trap. It's been called a bunch of things, and maybe it's all of those, but when did it start and what was it started for? And then we could talk about how it's evolved or devolved, however you want to define it, over the years and into what it wound up becoming.
That's an excellent question. So we know that Marion Petty, he joined the United States Army Air Corps at a very early age. He actually falsified his documents and supposedly threatened his parents so that he could join in his teenage years, you know, before the age of 18. And that's what ended up eventually happening. And so what he did was during the 1930s, 1940s, he actually owned some apartments on W Street within Washington, D.C. And he used them. He kept them as an open house, which is something the finders did throughout the entire operation. Now, the operation wasn't formed yet, but I am going to talk about Marion Petty's early life and then how eventually the finders operation came to fruition. Okay. So he literally says, I kept it as an Office of Strategic Services, which is a predecessor for the United States Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, the OSS. You know, I kept these apartments out and people would come in and come out and, you know, and then they would visit and then they would live and they would leave. So literally he kept open house for spooks. That's what he did. I mean, he did that initially way back then. All right. So later, you know, it turns out that he becomes a chauffeur for the Army Air Corps for Henry Hap Arnold. He starts chauffeuring very important people. Now, one of the breakthroughs that we found was that Marion Petty had a brother. His name was Russell Clinton Petty, and he was a detective. And he died during the 1950s and the result of a shootout. Okay. Now in his obituary, it talks about he was also a chauffeur for Henry Hap Arnold and these very important generals and world leaders. Now you might ask, well, who did Marion Petty chauffeur, John? Well, I mean, let's Lyndon Baines Johnson.
Okay.
You know, J. Edgar Hoover.
Oh boy.
And so actually let me get the list of everybody offhand. He chauffeured, but it was so he did George S. Patton, George C. Marshall, General Ira Aker, J. Edgar Hoover, Lyndon Baines Johnson, Henry S. Truman, and Dwight D. Eisenhower.
That's it. That's the upper echelon of the generals and presidents and future presidents of the United States.
So both him and his brother. You know, before, you know, his brother would later leave the Army Air Corps and become a sergeant, you know, become in the police force. Mm-hmm. But that's what they would do is they would drive around these very important people, sometimes even to Camp David, you know. And so supposedly how Marion Petty got the capital, the ability to start, you know, which way he would start doing is buying more properties. He would start buying large amounts of farmland in the Nethers, Virginia, the upstate Virginia area, a little bit off from DC. You know, the Nethers region is on Highway 666, you know, and it's not too far. It's not too far out of DC. It's about 45 minutes out of Washington, DC Metro, maybe an hour. You know, so he started buying, I mean, hundreds of acres of farmland. Now he claims he got that, you know, ability to buy it at rock bottom cheap prices, supposedly. How he tells the tale in Toby Terrell's book, The Game Caller, who's a Finders member, by just playing poker with the Army Air Corps buds and his chauffeur salary. That's how he managed to buy all of this land.
So he's the original Dan Blazarian.
Yes, pretty much. Yes. Great. So that's what it was. That's how he got this money to buy what would be known as a free state. And I'll talk about more of that later. Where in reality, from the investigative leads memo, what seems to be true was that, you know, Marion Petty was, you know, taught intelligence at Georgetown. His handler was a Chinese defector named Joseph Chang, who also worked for the National Press Club, who also taught Marion Petty martial arts. And they, end up being introduced to Charles Edward Marsh through the National Press Club, which Marsh was kind of like this big media newspaper like owner. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so he financed a lot of what Petty ended up doing, you know, with along with, you know, the military industrial complex and the Central Intelligence Agency. Because remember, Petty got supposable intelligence training through Georgetown. Right. He got Jesuit trained. And so, you know, that's where, you know, this ends up so he meets Marsh through Chang through the National Press Club. And then Marsh, you know, Petty's, you know, telling him the CIA's, you know, in with Marsh. You know, Marsh is one of Marsh, I think it was Marsh's wife had an affair with LBJ. Okay, so it's all like this incestual connection, right? Mm-hmm. You have Marsh's wife having an affair with LBJ, but Marion Petty driving LBJ, but Marsh, you know, lends the money, you know, through the CIA, through the military industrial complex,
very dirty,
to Petty to purchase all this land. Okay, and so that's where he ends up building kind of like this, you know, which later is used for the counterculture movement. I'll discuss that. It was like the Free State of all this land and around the Nethers region. Okay. So Marion Petty, you know, he through the 40s and the 50s, he's still in the military. He's still traveling. But eventually he claims that he just, you know, goes up to the Pentagon. He's like, I don't want to do it anymore. You know, I don't want to be in the military anymore. I want out. And they just let him out. Okay. Literally, that's the story goes pretty much. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that to be true at all.
She dipped.
Yeah, very much so.
Okay.
So that's when he starts actually, you know, on the behest of, you know, the military industrial complex, on the behest of the Central Intelligence Agency, he starts making a group of people. He starts making connections. That's when the Finders operation really starts to begin to come to fruition, is during that time period. And so it's around the 1960s. It's kind of labeled as, like you mentioned earlier, kind of like a hippie commune. Mm-hmm. But we do know by a chancery lawsuit of former Finders members in the mid-90s that up into that point, the Finders operation with all the property and all the assets were worth $2.4 million.
And this was in the 60s?
Well, that was in the 90s.
In the
90s. Okay. By that point. Okay. And he started having property by that point. You know, he had a warehouse in Washington, D.C., a warehouse in the San Francisco area, properties all throughout the United States and all throughout the world. You know, and even Marion Petty's passport through the Washington, D.C. Chronology memo that was released, he had stamps. And, you know, even Toby Terrell mentions of going to the USSR and, you know, China during the 1980s. Okay.
Wow.
During the Cold War era. But Marion Petty's passport had stamps to North Korea, to the USSR, to China from the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s.
How?
And they were, you know, the Customs Department was talking and the FBI were talking with the State Department to try to figure out, how does some guy just happen to be able to get in North Korea? How's this guy, you know, how's he happen to get in the USSR during the Cold War? How's he happen to get into China? You know, like how does a person just walk into North Korea after the Korean War?
You have to be allowed in. Yeah, there's obviously intelligence ties. I think that goes without saying, but that's really interesting. So is it fair to say that the Finders became an international organization?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes. Very much so. And they work with foreign intelligence, like the Mossad. There's a weird in one of the FBI leaks from the vault. And I can understand some people go, well, John, you're trying to verify all this from all the information that the FBI has and from newspaper articles, newspapers, the Fourth Estate. So is really what you're verifying is, it could it just be all information that's leaked out to the government? What's really true or not? My answer to that is there is a possibility that all the information we have about the Finders is incorrect. All right. Yeah. But we have to at least base it on, if you add in all the information together of eyewitness accounts of the newspaper, the news stories, information that's been released by the government, some redacted, some unredacted. For example, the Tallahassee police reports are not redacted at all, but in the FBI documents, they're completely redacted, you know? Gotcha. So, I mean, I either have to say if I can verify from multiple sources, it's probably true. Mm-hmm. you know, the infamous Israeli spy was pardoned by Trump. He's mentioned in the FBI documents of having connections to Marion Petty. Now, it's heavily redacted. I can't tell heads to tell what it really is, but it's there and his name's there and it's in reference to Marion Petty. So
that's something, you know.
So, yeah. I mean, it's tough. It's tough sometimes because there are heavily redacted documents to really, you know, if it's without my knowledge of the case. I mean, there's even stuff in there that even I still can't figure out, you know, because it's so heavily redacted. And if it, and why is it so heavily redacted if there's nothing to hide?
Because there's plenty to hide. I think we all know that. So they come into existence and really start on the scene in the 60s. Counterculture, like you said, counterculture revolution, that's happening. Free love, kind of get away with a little bit more than normal because you can just say, hey, man, we're just outside of society right now. We're just doing our own thing. We don't want to be held to society's rules. And people can go, oh, I can dig that, man, because society's really messed up. And you go, and they go, yeah, that's right. That's what we're talking about. But they're onto something beyond just what is culturally acceptable. They're into some really dark stuff. So where do they go? How does this, what does the 60s look like for the Finders? Do they, is this the accumulation of assets? Is this, do they really start to find their niche in this, with regard to the children, or where are we seeing them in the late 60s?
The 60s is when Marion Petty starts gathering Finders members for the inner circle, which was known as the Crazies. Okay. So he starts getting, you know, the main core collective of the Finders throughout the 60s and the 70s. So when he's really influenced the counterculture movement, he's a founder of the World Future Society with Edward Cornish. And you have Roy Mason, who was an architect, who by investigative journalist Charles Soka, it was alleged that Roy Mason was an alleged pedophile. And was, you know, he was homosexual, and he was later murdered in some homosexual lover's tryst, that happened in the 1990s. That is, you can prove through, newspaper reports. But Mason himself, was the architect for the World Future Society. You know, Buckminster Fuller was a member of the World Future Society. I could bring up the list. I could talk a little bit about Barbara Marx Hubbard and why, because I think that she's one of the major, she gets a good chunk of my book, just because of, she's an elitist. I mean, she's the elite of the elite. Her father, Lewis Marx Sr., who owned this major, you know, toy factory. He was like a toy conglomerate at the time, who sold his toys through Sears Roebuck catalogs. He was a major financier to the Bush family, and was very good friends with Dwight Eisenhower and J. Edgar Hoover. Okay, and so Marx comes from a very elitist insider family, and so she actually develops a relationship with Jonas Salk, who Jonas Salk is the supposed creator of the polio vaccine. And Barbara Marx Hubbard is actually the early financier for the Jonas Salk Institute. Okay. And so actually Barbara Marx Hubbard leaves her family, and because Jonas Salk comes to visit with her. All right. So she abandons her family. All right. And it's weird, like the relationship that they end up having between each other and what they end up saying, because, you know, it's pretty much like, you know, he's like, oh, like talking to her when he goes and, you know, takes her from, or, well, I guess she willingly goes, but she abandons her family. You know, he's like, this is the Garden of Eden. And she's like, I'm Eve and I'm leaving, you know? So she like abandons her family for Jonas Salk. And Jonas Salk actually says that Barbara Marx Hubbard did more to push his beliefs than he ever could. Okay. Cause he believed in conscious evolution. Which a lot of the New Agers do, and it's a very an elite a belief in that a person is able to steer their evolution. Okay, and so the way that they look at it is anybody who has a religious belief system, like me being a Christian, I'm archaic, and so I won't be part of their one world religion, one world government. And so, you know, 1/4 of the population of the earth, which Barbara Marx Hubbard said this, you know, would have to be lovingly annihilated, excised, almost like a tumor that the elite or the Pale Horse Rider foretold in the Book of Revelation. And it's a calling. You know, I always look at Barbara Marx Hubbard as being like, so you're in hospice, you're on life support, you know? And she comes in and she's like the elderly nurse and she's like, oh, you're not going to live much longer, even though you may or may not recover. It's not up to her, you know? And so even though you're in hospice, there have been people who've been in hospice who have recovered. It's rare, but it does happen. You know, most people do die. And she's like, you know, well, out of love and light, out of how much I love you, I'm just going to smother you with a pillow as there's nothing you can do as I take you off life support, right. You know, because I love you so much.
Yeah.
You know, and so
this is a weird angle that the one world government people have where they're like, well, you know, it's the most like the Margaret Sanger thing, the most loving thing people can do is murder their infants. And you're like, I'm sorry, what did you say?
Yeah. So it's like, so she, you know, she like Jonah Salk is like, I could never do as much as this woman did. And it's like, wow. Okay. So like who's Barbara Marx Hubbard, right? So mm-hmm. Marion Petty is a founding member of the World Futurist Society, knew Edward and Sally Cornish for years. Okay. According to Toby Terrell book in his game, The Game Caller. And it's in the Investigated Leads memo as well, that Marion Petty founded the World Futurist Society. So prominent members of the World Futurist Society, some people, you know, you and your audience would recognize. Now, I didn't recognize everybody, but some, you know, and this isn't the full list, but some people I just want to go over because I think it's important, would be, Al Gore, former Vice President of the United States of America, Arthur C. Clarke, the famous, you know, British science fiction author that wrote 2001 A Space Odyssey. It was a co-writer of that.
Known pedophile.
Ben Goertzel.
Ben Goertzel from,
Sophia the Robot, who was very proud about his 100,000, you know, grant from Jeffrey Epstein. Mm-hmm. Okay. B.F. Skinner, Buckminster Fuller, Carl Sagan, Gene Roddenberry,
Star Trek creator.
Sir Isaac Asimov. Leonard Nimoy.
Okay.
Star Trek actor. So this person's interesting. Malcolm Willis McConaughey, also known as Adam Aristotle Starchild, American financial consultant, author, convicted fraudster, homosexual pedophile, and New Ager. Malcolm was the supposed leader of the homosexual child pornography ring, is known as the North Fox Island pedophile ring. Malcolm wrote the foreword to World Future Society member Isaac Asimov's book, Worlds Within Worlds, The Story of Nuclear Energy.
Whoa.
Now, the elite do have some obsession with the atomic bomb and atomic energy. I mean, Alice Bailey worshipped atomic energy. Barbara Marx Hubbard, which I have her book right here, Happy Birthday, Planet Earth. You might find interesting one part that she writes in here is, let's see if I can find it. She talks about what the elite have and that the average person should not have access to. And I agree that there's some things that that no one should have access to, actually, if you mean, you know, how I believe. Right. But she says, if the selfish were to inherit the evolutionary capacities, just what she's talking about with conscious evolution, Jonas Salk was a big proponent of, okay?
Right.
Earthly aspects of Christ's ability, which is complete blasphemy. Nuclear energy is the very first thing that she lists. Okay.
Okay.
Biotechnology, mm-hmm. mRNA,
yeah.
Longevity, self-replicating machines, the power to build new worlds. They would self-destruct in the process, destroy the whole.
Oh, good. Wonderful.
So we also have Maurice Strong.
You're insane.
I know they are, right? It's just Barbara Marx Hubbard, really just how evil this woman. I mean, she is just evil. Like there's no other way, you know, to put it. She is just there's very little, if anything, redeeming about this woman that I can think of. All right. So we have Maurice Strong, who's former United Nations, should I say, Under Secretary General, and former director of the World Future Society. He was also George Soros before George Soros.
Yes, he was.
Ray Bradbury, Ray Kurzweil, Stanley Kubrick, Walter Mondale, who gave a speech, but we don't know if he was necessarily a member. And, you know, it's my belief, I think the World Future Society is elitist, globalist, new age, transhumanist think tank, and is a lot of beliefs that we have in modern day science fiction that was influenced by many people like Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, Isaac Asimov, Ray Bradbury, Gene Roddenberry, which, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson's also a member of the World Future Society. Yeah. All right. And so they influence a lot of what we believe about, you know, science TM, you know, the science so falsely called, as Apostle Paul would say, and a lot of modern day science fiction malarkey.
Yeah, you know, for sure. Those are the guys. I mean, I'm surprised George Lucas isn't on that list.
Yeah, me too. I just haven't found him yet because they don't publish it, you know. So that was one of the main people during that time period that Marion Petty and the Finders Operation through the CIA had their biggest influence on was Barbara Marx Hubbard. And I mean, she, interestingly enough, when last name Barbara Marx Hubbard, you know, she even infiltrated the alternative media. She's been on numerous coast to coast AM shows. I've been interviewed even about the 2020 false mind stuff that never came to fruition. She was in a movie called Thrive, which was put forth by Foster Gamble, who is a so-called removed heir of the Procter & Gamble fortune. And in that movie, I mean, they have numerous truthers like David Icke, Alex Jones, John Perkins, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, Catherine Austin Fitz, G. Edward Griffin, long-term John Birch Society member, people like Amy Goodman, you know, Democracy Now!, Van Jones, CNN, Deepak Chopra, who's a major New Ager, who said Barbara Marx Hubbard is the voice of conscious evolution of her time. Edgar Mitchell is the founder of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which is heavily CNP funded through the Templeton Foundation. And so they're actually, some of those people actually came out after the movie and actually denounced it once they watched the whole entire movie. And the people like Amy Goodman, I guess I have issues with Amy Goodman, Democracy Now!, obviously, but she at least came out and was like, you know, what is this? You know, and this was in the early 2010s, but I still find it quite interesting that, you know, so-called truthers, well, none of them denounced Barbara Marx Hubbard. You would think that these truthers would be against Barbara Marx Hubbard, but yet nobody...
Do they know who she is? I've never even heard of her before.
Yeah. Would you not watch a documentary that you're on? And if you're listening to Barbara Marx Hubbard, you know, and she gives the same spiel that she gives, like anybody who has eyes, you know, to see and ears to hear, like you listen to her, like I could play you any random Barbara Marx Hubbard speech and you would be like, I can, you know, play her 1984 Democratic vice presidential speech and you would be like, you know, the Democrats are, you know, they don't call the Democrats for a reason, right? You know,
right.
The stuff she said is like, whoa.
A lot of times, I'll hear these people talk and they'll be going on and on and on. And I'll say, well, you know, if you come from a less suspicious background than me, you might go, oh, this sounds like a good idea. Like, oh, I see what you're talking about. But then I come from like a conspiratorial angle and I say, well, this is the sort of things that you would be saying if you were actually a really bad person trying to pretend like you were a good person and you wanted to consciously evolve. And like, oh, what does consciously evolve mean? And then they're like, oh, you know, have sex with kids when they're five. And you're like, I'm not into that. You know, or whatever their definition of conscious evolution is.
As like, they're trying to paint it as love and light, you know?
Yeah, they're painting it as love and light. They're like, listen, let's reduce the age of consent to 12 or 8. And you're like, how does this get us to evolve? They're like, we get to that later on once you're in the cult.
I mean, that's how the elites are pushing things, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I mean, that's what the Finders were doing during this time period. The operation were, you know, working with people like Barbara Marx Hubbard, like Roy Mason, like Hunter Patch Adams.
What's his connection into this? Because they made a movie about him and it's Robin Williams and he's this doctor and he puts on a clown face and makes all the sick kids happy. And then I don't even think I saw the movie. They run him out of the hospital or something. I don't know. It's Robin Williams. So it's funny and it's got kids and he's a clown and it's supposed to be true, but I don't know the ins and outs of it.
All right, so Hunter Patch Adams is a member of the Fighters Operation. He is. It was even a newspaper article after the Tallahassee incident that he was elected as a co-leader with Carl Shapley, the New Ager, and Stephen Weissman Esquire, who's a lawyer. Okay. So, you know, in Toby Terrell's book, The Game Caller, it's discussed that Patch Adams was given the money to fund his hospital, which is the Gesundheit Institute, was directly given money by Marion Petty to found that hospital. Okay. He attended
that's a direct connection. That's kind of hard to get away from.
he attended many Finders parties. His group was orbited around the Finders. The inner circle of the Finders were likely called the Crazies. His group was called the Zanies. Okay, because he was Dr. Zany Remorski. All right. Mm. And he, you know, believes in, you know, laughter therapy. Which I necessarily don't have an issue with that, but his kind of like his clowning institute or the training of clowns per se, actually he started the training during the 1980s with that of medical professionals learning the arts of medical clowning, for lack of better words, in the USSR during the Cold War during the 1980s. So that's weird. And then you have Wavy Gravy and Camp Win a Rainbow and clowning and the allegations supposedly about Wavy Gravy and, you know, the Free State and, man, like,
clowns are scary enough.
The Free State.
We don't need to introduce pedophile clown doctors into this whole thing. This is just,
I'm not saying nothing about Hunter Patch Adams that I know of. All I'm just saying is the Wavy Gravy connections or something. Yeah. Yeah. There's something there, allegedly, supposedly.
Yeah.
So I've seen no allegations against Hunter Patch Adams himself directly, but just him directly, I mean, getting funding for the Gesundheit Institute, as well as one interesting thing, too, as well. And Wavy Gravy, working with the Fighters, again, counterculture of the Fighters, too, as well. Is that so Hunter agreed to become an honorary chair of the International Association for the Advancement of Creative Maladjustment, IAACM. Mind Freedom International is a nonprofit coalition that is a sponsor group of the Gesundheit Institute, launched the IAACM to support creative maladjustment, a constant refusal of normalizing the reinforcing of inequality, anti-psychiatry stances, which I have my issues with psychiatry, but I'm going to talk about where this comes from in a minute. Okay. It's the poison pill. All right. And promotes radical social change. Mind Freedom seems to have partnered with the Scientology front group that it's literally Scientology, through Scientology, but it masquerades as anti-psychiatry, which is the commission, the Citizens Commission on Human Rights.
That just rang a bell. Tom Cruise, Matt Lauer, anti-psychiatry. He's a Scientologist, anti-psychiatry. Is there some sort of connection there?
Yes, there is. I mean, they push as they are the alternatives to psychiatry. I have my issues with the use of, you know, medications for psychiatric therapy and SSRIs and SNRIs and stuff and everything. Like, I'm not saying that I don't have any issues with the psychiatry, even the roots of psychology and psychiatry. William Reich, I hate to break it to a lot of people listening, but if you actually read his writings, most people don't. They just go on about orgone therapy, which I used to be a believer in.
Oh, who's this?
Wilhelm Reich. And so I used to be a practitioner many, many years ago of orgone therapy, but in Reich's own words, orgone therapy comes from the innocence of children, and Reich likely was a pedophile himself.
Yeah.
And there's been many allegations have come out, even his family, about that's the reason why Reich had to keep moving around was because in the basements they were, you know, having children and teenagers masturbate and. Yeah, so you might want to read Reich himself, who, when he was a teenager, used to masturbate his horses and get off to that.
Yeah, that's automatic disqualification.
So people out there that idolize Wilhelm Reich, who I used to because orgone therapy, and I understand that, you just read the man. Okay. Just read the man. Because the moment you read him, you're like, no.
If you're jerking off horses, I'm not interested in anything else you're saying after that point. You know what I mean? That's my line in the sand.
And I think the book, which, of course, the Reich Foundation gets so up about, I think it's called like Adventures in Orgasmatron, I think is the name of the book. But it's, if you want to learn all about William Reich, go read that book. All right. And so people like Marion Petty, you know, he kind of idolized Wilhelm Reich in some ways, you know, and there's a lot about Reich in my Substack and in my book that I'm writing, you know, that is just interesting idolization there, you know. And a lot of people are fooled by the Reich Foundation and about Orgone Energy, about how good it is for you. Mm-hmm. But after reading Reich myself, to get down to the bottom of it, I do really need to do a show on Wilhelm Reich. I don't want to have anything to do with this at all. Like, this is not good. And I know that might upset a lot of people, but again, just go read his autobiography. We'll read Wilhelm Reich's autobiography. That should be enough. Yeah. That should be enough.
So but, there's like quasi, you've got a lot of these concepts sort of circling around the founders. You've got this psychology. You've got the pedophilia. I mean, quietly, pedophilia is inserted into this discussion as well. You've got the intelligence agencies. You've got
the mind control elements.
Mind control. Yeah, mind control elements to it. This sounds like... it's starting to sound very cult-like. Now I understand why they call this, why they had described it as cult-like or communal lifestyles and all of that. And that would also explain, seems like they were on the move quite a bit. Is that true? Did they move around? Or was it like there were franchises in different...
Well, they had central locations like the W Street Apartments, the Washington, D.C. warehouse, but they constantly, because Marion Petty was called the game caller, so he would call games. So he would tell people where to go, and it was up to them whether or not they went. But, you know, so he would be like, hey, I need you to, like, he would tell Toby, hey, I need you to go to China. I need you to go, you know, I need you to go to Russia. China, come back through. Like, I need you to go here. I need you, this person, to do this. And Marion Petty would never say he was a leader. Sometimes he would say the women of the fighters operation was a leader, which is completely not true. And I'll get to that in a minute. And, you know, he would never outright say, unless he was cornered in a box, I'm the leader. Okay. But he was, right, obviously. So they did a lot of traveling. It wasn't like, you know, they were in a central location. I mean, there were central locations where they would come to, like the W Street Apartments in Washington, D.C., or the warehouse in Washington, D.C., or the Free State Endeavors. But they were always constantly on the move. Marion Petty himself was always constantly on the move. He would actually take military flights anywhere he'd want to in the world. Now, you know, there are people within the Army Air Corps at the time, you know, supposedly in the military, supposedly too, that you could take military flights if you're, you know, a veteran. That is true. Like, I'm not going to say that there's something suspect in and of itself about that. But, you know, he would do that. You know, he would just go somewhere. Like, they talk about, like, Toby Charles talks about frequently in his book that Marion would just disappear, or he would show up, you know, and he, you know, so that's when you know, so there is kind of like a almost agent aspect,
right,
of that.
Yeah. 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 It's one of the other guys that whose names I would hear. And I might as well ask you, since I don't know if he connects in at all, is Michael Aquino. Does he have connections to this, or is that a separate thing? Because we're talking about military intelligence, Satanism, cult-like behavior, possibly pedophilia, or more than likely pedophilia. And that's a West Coast operation, Presidio-type San Francisco area. Was that in any way tied to them? Did they work together? Did they know each other? How was that?
I have no information.
Okay.
I can't speak to that because I don't know. Okay. I mean, we do know there's connections between Franklin and Michael Aquino through the transfer of Contra Barra bonds from Oliver North, CMP Oliver North, to Michael Aquino, with Lawrence E. King being in the room. So we know there's connections between Aquino and the Franklin scandal. But the connection to Aquino to the finders, I have no idea.
Okay. Good.
I have no direct connections. And I will say this, I guess we could talk about the Tallahassee
incident. Yeah, the Tallahassee incident is the one that I think gets most on the radar as, I mean, you know the story better. Van at a park, pulled kids playing around, looking kind of disheveled, kind of dirty. Police roll up. How does this go down? What's this?
Okay, so on February 4th, 1987, a concerned citizen named Cindy Peterson called into the Tallahassee Police Department to report that there were two gentlemen there was a van, one van, but there was two groups of finders, and there were two vans in the area, but there was only one van at the Myers Park in Tallahassee area. And she called to report that there were six children who were poorly dressed, bruised, dirty, and behaving like wild animals, accompanied by two very well-dressed males. The two well-dressed males were Finders Operation members Douglas Edward Ammerman and James Michael Hollowell, who were in their late 20s. They were driving a white 1979 Dodge Sportsman van with a Virginia license plate. At approximately 4:50 p.m., Tallahassee police officers Tony Mashburn and Judy Sashoki arrived at Myers Park to investigate the concerned citizen's phone call. Officer Mashburn mentioned they arrived on the scene that the children were very dirty and unkempt. Ammerman and Howell claimed they were teachers from Washington, D.C. en route to take the kids to a school for brilliant children in Mexico. Both men were very evasive when they were asked if they were the children's parents, and that Howell refused to talk to the Tallahassee police and fainted. He lay down on the ground and refused to get up, so he planked. He was carried off by officers in the patrol car. Michael Howell also had two forms of Miranda rights with him when he was arrested. One copy stated he had something to hide, another copy stating he had nothing to hide. Both men were charged with child abuse on February 4th, 1987, and giving a $100,000 bond each. Inside the van, a couple of interesting things to note, was a TRS-80 computer, which was later taken by the United States FBI agents Jim Whitaker and Matt Pellegrino on Sunday, February 8, 1987. And one message was copied down and given back to the Tallahassee Police Department. We don't know what that message is. A piece of paper titled The Ballad of Ballards. Which was released in one of the FBI vault documents, which was mostly intact, not really redacted. It just gives kind of like a ballad history of the finders, which is very interesting. It talks about them having other locations and stuff like that and other warehouses, which we know to be true within there. A Chinese English dictionary.
Whoa.
Now, the very interesting thing about that is the numerous connections to the finders operation in China. The fires operation would visit China frequently, according to Toby Terrell in his book, The Game Caller. Chinese nationals would also frequently stay in the W Street apartments. According to United States Customs Special Agent Ramon J. Martinez, the finders were participating in child trafficking within China. And finally, the Ballads of Ballads found in the van mentions China, among other locations, including San Diego, the Free State, Washington, D.C., and Hawaii, where there were branches of the fighters operation. You also had Douglas Ammerman and Michael Howell's passports. Now, the interesting thing is the timeline that we have is, I guess to circle back, and the reason why that's important is because this is what supposedly went on. Okay, so they had the slaughtering of the goats, which I believe was a ritual sacrifice of the goats, which they were put in a photo album that was found called The Execution of Henrietta and Igor. Okay, so in this event where Hunter Patch Adams, when discussed, called it animal husbandry. It was this animal husbandry exercise that they showed these children, ages, you know, from 6 to 1. They slaughtered the goats. They poured, you know, Henrietta was pregnant, so they cut open, you know, the womb and pulled out the fetuses of the developing goats. And one of the child was given to hold a goat on a silver head on a silver platter. And they're wearing all these robes, which the finders claimed it was just white cloths to keep their clothes from getting dirty, which may or may not have been true. Most people that just deflected from there, that goes, oh, well, kids just don't know where their meat comes from. And it was very normal for butchers to put on a show like this to their children. So it was just a good way for them to learn animal husbandry, which Patch Adams said that to the news report. And so, to myself, the grand maximum, my belief, and I do try to check myself as a Christian, you know, am I allowing, you know, which I do believe true Christian worldview to kind of muddy these things, I do believe it was a ritual sacrifice because it's weird. For one, it's weird. It's not, you can't excuse it as being animal husbandry. The kids are too young. Like if they're teenagers, you know, 16 or 15, you know, when I was doing anatomy and physiology and cutting open animals, you know, sure, whatever. All right. Like, hey, you know, we're going to, you know, these goats are on the farm. We got to butcher them. It's getting too cold. We're going to eat their meat. You know, you want to come see how I butcher a goat? You know, sure, fine, whatever. Okay. But these kids are ranging from 7, 6 to 1. You know, yeah. It's like no kid should be watching that. And no farmer would take their like 1 to 3 year old kid and be like, I'm going to butcher this goat right in front of you. You know, they may be doing their work and a kid might come up. Right. But they're not going to be like, let's watch me. You know, no, that's that can't just be because we have modern proclivities, Charlie.
No, and you would get
believe that.
Benefit of the doubt if you were just somebody that actually lived on a real farm and was doing this. But when you have all these other kind of intelligence ties and pedophilia ties and all this, you know, ritualistic mind control ties, the idea that you're just focusing on animal husbandry is laughable. Of course, that's not what they're doing. I'm in agreement with you that there was some sort of ritual going on. And of course, we know these people that are in high ranking secret or semi-secret societies have a very, you know, they find rituals are important to their way of life. And so it's not uncommon to find them engaging in that. So I think that that's reasonable to think that they were up to something more devious.
And it was in a photo album called The Execution of Henrietta and Igor. Like you couldn't call it something else, like, you know, Children's Husbandry Project, or, you know, January, you know, 1987 when we slaughtered the goat, or something, you know, it has to be called that, you yeah, know?
It's weird.
And so, I mean, I think it was some sort of mind control satanic ritual, but what do I know, you know? And so they found a brown canvas bag containing some nude photos of children, a pack of Trojan condoms, you know, the fire's operation, where children were starving by the time they arrived at the Tallahassee police station, were interviewed on February 4, 1987. Many of them did not have clean clothes or underwear. James Michael Howell III did not wear a diaper. The children were filthy. They wore mismatched socks. They said stated they were only giving food like oranges, bananas, carrots, and potatoes to eat as a reward if they were good. You know, I will say this. I'll talk about this in a minute. I guess I should say this first. The children were not in and of themselves trafficked, okay? Like they were children of the Finders Operation members, okay? Like, okay. For example, again, I said, you know, James Michael Hollowell III, he was around 2 years old, he was male. He went by the moniker John Paul Pope. Well, his father was James Michael Hollowell, who was arrested. He just didn't, for some reason, say, this is my kid, you know, which right. is weird, but he didn't. Okay. Right. And his mother was Finders member Paula Arrico. Now, one of the oldest children, Jordan Messina Arrico, her stepfather was James Michael Hollowell, you know, and her mother was Paula Arrico. And so, okay. So do I believe that these children were sexually abused? I don't have any proof. I don't. And some of them have gone on the record and said they were not in modern time. Okay. Do I believe that they were, they dealt with physical abuse outside of a non-sexual nature? They dealt with neglect and they dealt with mental abuse. I do.
Right.
Now, there was a doctor called Dr. Nyman Greenberg. Okay. And he worked at the Chicago Masonic Hospital. He founded CAUSES, which is kind of like this psychiatry, like child abuse investigatory. Mm-hmm. Business. He would be called in for McMartin and would first kind of validate Key McFarland's McMartin beliefs, but then later would be used by the McMartin defense to kind of cast aspersions on McFarland and believe the children's tactics. Okay. And I would always say this, I believe the grand maximum that there was satanic abuse going on in McMartin. There was likely elite involvement, you know, but I would say the bare minimum, which was done in a book called The Witch Hunt Narrative, which is an excellent book. If you want no conspiracy, you just want the facts by Rossi Chet Brown professor, this is it. This book is it. Okay. And in this book, it lays out the case that at the bare minimum, there were children that were molested by Raymond Buckey. All right. In McMartin. All right. At the bare minimum. Yep. That's what happened. There's no denying it was a satanic panic in that regard. Raymond Buckey was an alleged, you know, pedophile and child rapist. All right. I mean, there's even court documents of him at the preschool wearing short shorts, his mother checking him for boners, and him reading Playboys with kids on his laps. All right. Yikes. Me as a father, that ain't happening.
No.
All right. No, first of all, no kids sitting on anybody's lap that I, you know, that I don't know personally. All right. Family member, you know, like that ain't happening. All right. And second, definitely not when they're wearing short shorts and reading Playboys. And why is he wearing short shorts and reading Playboys inside of preschool?
None of that works for me.
So, and interestingly enough, you might find this interesting. Toby Terrell was sent out to McMartin after the Tallahassee incident to see what was going on and what the atmosphere was out there. He was given a game to go out to Manhattan Beach.
Really?
That's in his book, The Game Caller. That's interesting. That's interesting. So, you know, the abuse findings were done by Jane Patella of Florida Health and Rehabilitation Services and Dr. Moore. Now, Dr. Moore's dead. I tried to reach out to him. He's deceased. I can't. Though, I don't know, because of HIPAA laws, if he could even go on the record and tell me. Okay.
Right.
But the evidence that was reported was Jordan Orrico had a partial hymen break on the right. Her right hymen was broken. That necessarily isn't indicated of sexual abuse. Okay. And above itself. And Max Livingstone had issues with a lack of anal sphincter control. Now, they did say that that could be consistent with previous sodomy. It's possible, but it also could be consistent with their very, very poor vegan diet and constant fasting.
Oh, yeah.
As someone who has written books on digestive health and is an expert on digestive health,
yeah,
that could happen. It's very common for people who are chronically constipated to develop a prolapse anus. I've coached people. It's disgusting. All right.
Right.
So again, I can't sit here and say that they were molested when I don't have the evidence.
Right.
And it was walked back. Now, you could say it could have been walked back because of pressure.
Yeah.
But we don't know. I don't have the medical examiner report in front of me. I can't say that because I can't just make allegations of what I can't prove, you know. Now, was there trafficking going on that can be proved outside of these children? And were there acts of pedophilia or ephebophilia that happened? Yes. I mean, I have a guy on record who lived in the basement of the Finders operation. We'll call him Tom. And we have Charles Soka, who knew the Finders, investigative journalist, and what he spoke of. The Finders were going to bus stops in the Washington, D.C. area under the guise of feminism and trying to coerce women to come back to the Finders operation to have orgies with them and Marion Petty, because Marion Petty preferred young pussy compared to old pussy. All right. So were there women that went back that were underage? Yes, that makes it statutory rape right then and there. Right. There's no if, ands, or buts about it. I don't care. It's the times. I don't care. It was the 70s. I don't care. That's statutory rape. And I've actually been called a Me Too proponent because of that, just because I'm like, look, if they're 16 or 15, that's automatically statutory rape. Like, there's no if, ands, or buts about it. All right. It just is. All right. Now, were there some women that were coerced through drug use, through peer pressure to have orgies and necessarily didn't want to do it? Yeah. And that's rape. That's right. Yeah. Was that every instance? No, I'm pretty sure there were women who wanted to have sex that were of age, you know. So there were, that's something that I can verify of very horrendous acts and things going on. Okay. Mm-hmm. Then there was the reports of what we got from Ramon J. Martinez's and the customs department that there was human trafficking, there was child trafficking going on, you know, and I've spent a crux of my book proving, was Ramon J. Martinez's custom report real? Yes, I actually talked to his partner. And his partner said that he used to have his own report and it's disappeared. It used to be out there on the Usenet kind of like databases. Mm-hmm. And it's gone. And he was a computer guy. We spent hours looking for it. We couldn't find it. He actually told me more information when the Finders warehouses were raided the night before, the Chinese neighbors of the warehouse that they had next to them reported that the Finders loaded the vans up with documents and computer equipment because they were running a CIA computer training enterprise called Future Enterprises at, you know, they're training the CIA agents and computers at the warehouse, you know. So they were loading up all this computer equipment and all of these, you know, documents the night before. They got tipped off the night before. All right. And so him as a computer guy, he goes in there and he sees all these empty tables and these cords. And he's like, what? And he looks at the tables and knows, well, the tables haven't been dusted, but the outlines of the tables are computer equipment. So what happened here? You know, and that was never before known previously beforehand either. And that would be Robert Harold, Ramon J. Martinez's former partner. Okay. So they were tipped off before then. All right. And there was one thing that came out in the FBI, you know.
Yeah, the FBI dropped a 324-page file on this. Was there anything good in that?
Well, they did. Yeah, but there's been more. They actually released another recent one a few weeks ago.
Oh, really?
So they keep adding more. All right. So here they have. Now, this has happened after the 1987 incident. All right. Report of investigation by the Metropolitan Police Department, Division Intelligence, Branch Organized Crime. Okay. Report, October 22, 1991, possible child pornography. Okay. I do believe that they were shooting pornography and likely child pornography at the warehouse. Detective John Stitcher, which even in Toby Sorrell's book, The Game Caller, makes fun of Stitcher, which I believe it was covered up by the FBI, by the CIA, all the finders involved in all of this, okay, was covered up by them, all right? Stitcher's yelling, you know, in the, like, red in the face at his partner, Jim Bradley, I think, actually, Stitcher later died of a heart attack a few years after this, but Bradley kind of helped control it, to my knowledge, too, as well. All right. And so, you know, Stitcher's like yelling to Toby Terrell, who, by the way, Athenia Veronis, who is the FBI agent who Terrell says, you know, went there to quote unquote fix it and make it disappear. But he doesn't write it like that. He writes it as like, you know, she's a goddess and she came to tell the truth. And, you know, and Ramon, you know, paints it out that Veronius like was involved in the cover up. Right. And she was actually who supposedly Clarice Starling was based off of.
Oh, all right. Really?
And she runs a paranormal investigation outfit in North Carolina in the Greensboro area. Now, I want to try to talk to her. I don't think she would talk with me. I don't think any of the members of the finders talk to me at this point, to be honest with you. I just don't think they would. But so, you know, she was there to kind of my belief and Ramon's belief to allegedly kind of to cover it up. Or if she didn't, she did a horrible job. All right. So, you know, Stitcher's yelling at Toby Terrell in his face. I know you're shooting pornography at that warehouse. I know you're shooting child pornography at that warehouse. And the customs report, they talk about an area. They had a staging area where they were shooting stuff at. You know, and so here we have on October 22nd, 1991, the undersigned received a telephone notification from Officer Blank, 5th District Uniform, Midnight Section, home telephone number Blank. Officer advised that he and two footmen officers, Blank and Blank, have observed activity which they believe is suspicious in nature. The officers have observed numerous well-dressed males. Finders were always well-dressed. Who operate rental cars and expensive luxury type models enter the building located at Blank at late and early morning hours. Subject and their vehicles do not fit the area in which the building is located, namely the market area of NE. Northeast, I guess Washington is what they're saying. On at least one occasion, the officers have observed adult males with a young male child enter the building. This occurred after the midnight section had reported for the duty on the street. Another occasion, Officer Blank stopped a van after it was observed leaving the building in the early morning hours. The van displayed tags which were not listed to a van. The operator identified himself as Blank. He told Officer Blank that he did research stuff, finder. He also stated that he babysat children for diplomats.
Whoa.
Officer Blank advised the undersigned that the building in the neighborhood is not fit for babysitting activity, especially after midnight. The subject's story was very suspicious to Officer Blank. The van is listed to Blank, white male. The vehicle is described as Blank. Officer advised that to the best of his recollection, this building is the same building which was raided by the police approximately blank years ago for some type of child pornography.
Holy moly.
And we all know that, and also too, finders member Theodore Gregory Reese, who docked computers at Georgetown, he was busted for child pornography in his late 80s, a few years back. So I'm not saying that every single person in the finders, again, I can't, you know, point them all to the bush and say they're all guilty of everything. Okay. I can only say what I know of who. Okay. Mm-hmm. Like, if I have specific knowledge. Theodore Gregory Reese was charged with child pornography in his 80s.
That's crazy to me. I mean, you don't ever settle down. You don't get to be 80 and then just kind of lose the desire, I guess.
Well, he was married. He was married with kids. I mean, you know, it's
so gross. Where do things stand right now with the Finders? Are they operational?
I have no idea. Some beliefs that they're broken up, some beliefs that they're still operational, that they're branched out further. Really don't know. There was a Finders ARG that showed up on 4chan a few years ago when they were trying to do all these advanced reality games. The Discordians were to try to bend reality and try to like use chaos magic, which some people argue some of that was to get Trump in. But there was a Finders ARG that came out, and I don't really know what, you know, Derek Brooks, I don't know what to think of it. Like, they said it was Finders member Stuart Miles Silverstone, but he's in his 90s, and I just don't know. Like, I can't verify a lot of that stuff. I mean, the Finders members are still out there. You know, they can be found. I wouldn't go harass them or try to talk with them. You're not going to get a lot of information out of them, yeah. You know, but, and then we don't know who truly is guilty of what, you know, that's the thing is, you know, do I believe that there was trafficking going on? Yeah, I do. Do I believe that there were acts of rape and pedophilia going on? Yeah, I do. Do I believe that there was, you know, searing of the counterculture movement and intelligence gathering? Yeah, I do. It's just who was all involved, who all knew, you know, that's the $1 million question.
Yeah. Since we'll wrap up with this one, since this guy's name, and you tell me if I'm out of line for making this potential connection, but we've got in the 70s, George H.W. Bush, CIA director. We've got him becoming vice president in the 80s. We've got the homosexual call boy ring taking tours of the White House late at night. We've got a lot of George H.W. Bush overlap. We know he's a deeply disturbed, or was a deeply disturbed individual who was involved with child trafficking and all of this. Did his name ever come up in any of the Finders documents?
No.
Okay.
I mean, outside of Barbara Marks Harbor and the World Future Society and Barbara Marks Harbor being a financier to the Bushes, that's all I got.
Okay.
There was an instance that was weird that one of the kids said, let me find it. Give me a minute.
Yeah.
This isn't Bush, but this is Reagan. So, Max Livingstone mentioned that his foster family, that the mothers in the Finders operation wore a lot of lipstick and jewelry. That Marion Petty made Kenny and Michael Hollowell spank him, and that a man named Mr. Reagan owned everything. Who's Mr. Reagan? You know, that's what I'm asking, is like, who's Mr. Reagan? You know, so I don't know. I mean, a lot of this stuff, did they all interconnect? Probably in some level. I'm not going to say that's not likely. It probably is likely. How much do they interconnect and how much can be proven? I have no idea. You know, a lot of this stuff was going on. McMartin, the Finders, Franklin, all around the same time.
Yeah.
You know, so does it all connect? Probably. But trying to figure out how it all connects and being able to prove it, that's a whole different arduous task.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, the kids, after the Tallahassee incident, the kids in and of themselves do seem to be functioning well. Somewhat, from what I can tell, like they seem to have normal lives, except for one of them. And I won't say who that is, but he wants to have nothing to do with anyone at all.
Whoa.
But he won't go on the record why. So
it's a dark topic. You know, this stuff is, and like I said, I had Nick Bryant on here. It's like, you don't want to go into this because of what you might find, but the dilemma is, what do we just, do we allow that to be the barrier that causes us to turn around and go back and say, all right, well, I don't want to know what's going on in there because I know it's going to be bad, so I'll pretend like it doesn't happen, and then that problem exists? Or do we take the opposite approach, which is, we got to talk about this stuff, we have to acknowledge that this exists. It's dark. It's as dark as you can get. You know, when you're talking about kids, when you're talking about trafficking and sexual abuse and physical abuse and mental abuse, and how you measure that and what that does to somebody and what that does to a group of people, everything about that is terrible. And I take the
I come at it from, I want to talk about it so that people are aware of it, not dwelling on it, not, you know, making themselves depressed over it, but in case the next time they're at a park and there's an unmarked van and six dirty kids running around, maybe they pick up the phone and go, this reminds me of something. Or maybe they see a bruise on a kid and they're now in tune looking for this, not because they're obsessed over looking for child's, you know, somebody abusing a child, but they're just, they recognize that this could happen. And therefore, when they see something, it makes it a little bit more likely that they'll say something about it. And then the problem will get fixed. I don't know. It's tough to talk about it. It hurts my soul. I know it does for you. You've been working on this for a while. Tell us, let's wrap up with this part. Tell us about the book. Like, is it, where are you in the process? When's this coming out? Because I have a feeling that this is going to be a big one.
Yeah, I'm putting it out right now on my Substack, $5 a month, $50 a year subscription for it. I'm piecemealing it. I'm almost done with chapter two. I got about 110 roughly pages out already of it. Hopefully I'll be done maybe by the beginning of next year, if I continue, you know, writing, which the Substack's actually helping me because it's forcing me to write and it's making me push through any writer's block I may have.
Yeah.
You know,
we'll have the link in the description too for your Substack. If people want to go and read about this, obviously it's really fascinating. You sent me some, I read it. This, and also to support you to look, these are not big money making operations, just in case, just to sort of let the cat out of the bag for people when you write books, especially books that don't get picked up by Simon and Schuster and get this broad distribution. If you're writing something that's independent, you are really writing this as a labor of love. So if there's people out there that have the ability to financially support John's work, I would certainly ask you to consider doing that, because that allows people to keep going. Like, you know, I don't make a lot of money on the books, but I love writing them, and that to me is more valuable than the money. So
yeah, I've spent hundreds of hours researching and writing and doing streams. I had to take all my streams down off of YouTube and put them on my Libri, just because they were getting flagged. They were getting flagged for cyber stalking, harassing, and bullying. As a disclaimer, I tell people, I'm like, look, don't go harass the fighters member. We really don't know who, you know, knows what or who was involved in what. You know, I'm not saying that you can't investigate it. You know, especially if anybody's an investigative journalist or an author, I can't say that you can't, you know, maybe reach out to them, you know, nicely, you know, to the best manners, the best of your ability, you know, and try to, I'm not saying that at all, but I'm just saying is since we don't know really, you know, we can't just, because it makes it more difficult. It makes it more difficult for people to investigate. It makes it more difficult for people to get down to the truth of, you know, of what's happening. And so there's a fine line between investigating and actually truly harassing somebody, whether if we think they deserve it or not, you know? Right. So it's tough. You know, and a lot of people give me pushback. You know, they're like, you know, there is a lot of conspiracy. Well, I guess one last thing, a lot of conspiracy narrative being pushed forth we all make mistakes. I mean, I've made mistakes. You know, when I went into the finders, I believed the conventional narrative that the six kids were trafficked, you know, and right. Now the evidence points to, no, there was their parents. Now, you know, was there possible sexual abuse? Maybe, I can't prove it. But was there, you know, emotional and physical trauma and mental trauma? Yes, of course. Of course, they were neglected. And even Dr. Nyman Greenberg, I guess I didn't finish to say that, even he came to that conclusion. Like, he was like, I can't, you know, definitively prove sexual abuse, but I can say these children were neglected, you know, and he did as limited hangout as he was. And he even, you know, was limited hangout for the Jewish Community Center, which I'm covering that on my Patreon, you know. But on the fighters, even he couldn't even, you know, he was like, yeah, there was some, you know, mental abuse. There was some neglect going on. Like, it's obvious.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, yeah. So, but I mean, you're right. There's not any, unless you get picked up. And I don't think my fighters book is going to get picked up by a major literary giant.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, yes, you do want to get paid for your work, obviously, but I'm not expecting to make millions of dollars off of this and getting national New York Times bestseller recognition, you know, but it is something that I believe does deserve to be out there, because, you know, it is, you know, good for the general public to know of this stuff and you know, to see how wicked and fallen, a lot of the government and the supporting of this and the organizations that came out of it, it's literally a laid bare view of the controlling of the 60s and 70s. It's almost me continuing a lot of ways Dave McGowan's work, at least the second chapter of trying to pushing, the co-option of the counterculture movement. Yeah. And human potential movement, which Dave McGowan did, in World Weird Scenes. And lest we forget, Dave McGowan didn't make a lot of money off of his books either, as much as he's respected and worked as a barista, to survive,
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Yeah. It's, these are fascinating stories. They're horrible. A lot of people are suffering because of what happened here. And I think that might be yet another reason for us to not forget it. And it doesn't mean we have to dwell on it, but we do have to understand what's out there, what these intelligence agencies are capable of, what these groups tend to do with kids when given access. And when you get tipped off the day before that you're about to get your warehouse raided, you can get all your stuff out of there. It's really dirty. It shows government involvement, as we always suspected, and it's horrible. John, where's the best place for people to find your work and support what you are doing?
We've read the documents on YouTube. We've underscore read on Twitter. I have a link at the top, the link tree to my Substack. Patreon, it's subscribe, so all the links are there. I'm not really good at pushing my own stuff. I'm never was a good salesman.
Well, let me be the salesperson for you for 1 second. If there's ever some new character that comes on the scene that I've never heard of, some government guy or some dude who comes into prominence, and I want to know who he's connected to, the guy I ask is John Brissom. That's John Brissom, everybody.
That's support his work.
You know how everybody is connected, and it's a true talent. If you liked this episode, and by like, I mean you thought it was important. Obviously, nobody likes the concepts of child trafficking and exploitation, but if you thought this was important, there's somebody in your life that might benefit from hearing this, please take the additional step right now of sharing this with your friends and family. If you like this, if you want to connect with me, the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. Thanks, everybody, and we'll talk to you later.